So let me start by talking about the phenomenon of ancient forgery, which is a term that I will be defining in a few minutes. But for now, just to give you a kind of a quick understanding of what I mean by forgery, I'm talking about a literary text, a book, a writing that whose author claims to be somebody that he's not. Okay, so a forgery would be somebody claiming to be somebody else. And that's all you need to know at this point for what I'm going to try and do in this talk. I want to start by talking about what Bible scholars have said about this phenomenon of forgery in the ancient world. One bit of background information that I suppose you do need is that there are a lot of texts from the ancient world that claim to be written by people who, in fact, did not write them. And you all are familiar with some of these texts, most of you are. For example, we have Gospels that claim to be written by Peter, or by Mary Magdalene, or by Judas Iscariot, or by, so we have these Gospels that in fact claim to be written by people who did not write them. Well, that's what I mean by a forgery. And I want to start by talking about what scholars have said about this phenomenon of forgery, which is fairly prominent in the ancient world. And so commonly held views among scholars, if you read what New Testament scholars, for example, say about these other Gospels or about other forgeries, there are a couple points of view that are very common in the scholars. First, that forgeries were easily detected. That in fact, when people wrote these things, they knew that people would realize that they weren't really Peter or they weren't really Judas Iscariot, and that it was fairly easy in the ancient world to detect a forgery when you saw it. And the corollary of that is that the person writing the forgery really didn't mean to deceive anybody, that everybody knew that this was a practice and it was a transparent practice, and that that people saw through it, and authors knew that people saw through it, and so they weren't really meaning to deceive anybody. So this is a point of view that you'll find frequently stated by scholars who write about forgery without, I might add, having actually read any ancient sources about forgery. It turns out that the ancient people talk about forgery, and they don't actually hold these points of view that you find in the scholars. You would think that the scholars would read some ancient sources on occasion. You would think. So, I mean, this happened. I don't know if you all know the Jesus Seminar puts out the sayings of Jesus that they think Jesus really said based on their evaluations of it. And they put out this book called The Five Gospels, which is Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Thomas, the Gospel of Thomas. And they color-coded it so that sayings that Jesus really said are in red, ones that he said something kind of like are in pink, ones that are really not very close are in gray, and ones he certainly did not say are in black. And so it's a color-coded thing. But at the beginning of this five Gospels, they start out by laying out some of the principles. And one of the things they claim is that in the ancient world, plagiarism was not discussed. There was no concept of plagiarism in the ancient world. They come out and say this, and if you read ancient sources, you just go, what in the world are they talking about? Of course the ancient people knew about plagiarism. They talk about plagiarism, and they condemn plagiarism. Plagiarism is the flip side of forgery. Forgery is when you claim to be somebody that you're not, so that you put your words onto somebody else's lips or on somebody else's pen. Plagiarism is the opposite. It's when you take somebody else's words and you put it out under your name. See, so it's the flip side. Well, ancient people talked about both forgery and plagiarism. And I want to talk about what the ancient evidence is with respect to these two commonly held views among scholars. I'm going to do this by giving a couple of examples. I'm going to start with a very interesting, and this is an example that's well known among classical scholars. It's an example of forgery committed by a guy named Dionysius the Renegade. He was called a renegade because he started out as a Stoic philosopher, and he ended up becoming kind of giving up on his Stoicism because he personally went through some suffering, and so he decided that Stoicism wasn't really the way to go, and he became a complete hedonist. and so he's known to history as Dionysius the Renegade. So let me tell you some things about Dionysius the Renegade. He lived in the 3rd century BCE. He was a a literary scholar who had a literary opponent whose name was Heraclides. Heraclides had been his teacher, and this Heraclides was one of the better known philosophers of the Hellenistic period, who had been the teacher of Dionysius, but Dionysius ended up turning on his teacher. One of the things that Dionysius did is he wrote a play called the Parthenopaeus. That was the title he gave to this play, and he wrote it in the name of Sophocles, the famous Greek playwright. And so he forged this play, claiming that it was in fact written by Sophocles when he was the one who had written it. Well, as it turns out, Heraclides, his literary opponent, was convinced that Sophocles had in fact written this play. And he quoted the play as a play of Sophocles. And when he did that, Dionysius, his enemy, sprang the trap and told him, no, in fact, you don't know a forgery when you see it. I forged this play. And Heraclides stuck to his gun. He said that, no, in fact, this is written by Sophocles. And Dionysius said, no, I wrote it. and Heraclides didn't believe him. And so, well, as it turns out, Dionysius had been very clever. The first few lines of the play in Greek, if you take the first letters of each of the first lines, they spelled a word. And the word they spelled was Ponkalos, who was Dionysius' lover. And so, see, he's leaving a hint in there. That, and he showed that to Heraclides, and Heraclides said, well, it's just an accident. It's serendipity. And so it turns out he had put other acrostics in the play. You know, an acrostic where you have the first word and he spells out a word. The next acrostic was a much longer one, and it was a little poetic couplet which said, an old monkey is not caught in a trap. Oh, yes, he's caught at last, but it takes time. In other words, it takes a while to convince somebody like Heraclides that, in fact, he's been deceived here. Heraclides still didn't believe it. And so then he went to the real coup de grace, which was an acrostic that said, Heraclides is ignorant of letters and is not ashamed of his ignorance. this is an instance in which somebody wrote a forgery in order to see if he could get away with it. Well, that only works if you do deceive people. You see, if people saw through it, it wouldn't work. And you mean to deceive people. This is this kind of forgery, when you forge something to see if you can get away with it, is called mystification. It's called mystification. And those of you who read the Biblical Archaeology Review will have read about the secret gospel of Mark. I frankly have not read the article. Herschel and I completely disagree on the secret gospel of Mark, and I know if I read that article, my blood pressure is going to go through the roof, because he tries to support that the secret gospel of Mark is in fact an authentic document, and I think it's forged. I think it's a mystification. I think Morton Smith forged it to see if he could get away with it, that he's the modern Dionysius the Renegade, and is equally successful. Anyway, so this is just one example of a forgery from the ancient world, where clearly it was not easily detected, and it was meant to deceive. Let me give you a couple of other examples more quickly. We learned from an ancient author named Diogenes Laertius that there was a fellow named Diotimus who was an enemy of the philosopher Epicurus. And he decided to get even with his enemy Epicurus by writing 50 obscene letters and putting them in circulation and signing them Epicurus. You see, so it looked like Epicurus had written these obscene letters. So then there's the instance of Galen. Galen was a very famous physician from the 2nd century Rome. There's a story about Galen that Galen tells us, where Galen was walking down the street one day and in Rome, and he passed by a bookseller shop. And in the shop of the bookseller, there were two people arguing over a book. And the book was a book that was allegedly written by Galen. And so Galen overhears this conversation. And one guy is saying, this book is Galen, this is really by Galen. And the other guy was saying, it's not by Galen, this is not his writing style at all. And this warmed the cockles of Galen's heart, because it turned out he had not written this book that claimed to be written by him. And so he went home that afternoon and he wrote a book which has been translated into English with the title, How to Recognize Books Written by Galen. because you know, he didn't like the idea that somebody's out there making money off of his book. So they're here again. Whoever did this was intending you to think he really was Galen, probably so he could make some money by selling the book. Another interesting instance of forgery involves a little known event during the reign of the Emperor Aurelian in the 3rd century. Aurelian had a guy on his staff named Eros who incurred the displeasure of the Emperor and was going to be punished. Eros forged a list of names in the emperor's name. He forged a list of names of people that the emperor was going to have executed for treason against the state, and he circulated the list, which had its desired effect. The people who were named on this list rose up and they assassinated the Emperor Aurelian. So my point is, when somebody forges something, they're doing it for a reason, and the reasons almost never work unless the forgery is successful. And so that's, you know, these are just examples, but you could go case after case through the ancient world and find all sorts of examples of similar sorts of things. So my conclusion is that scholars today who say that that forgery was never meant to deceive anybody and the forgers themselves were easily detected, well, I think that in fact is completely wrong. Well, let me move to some definitions so we know what we're talking about before we continue talking about it, of some relevance to this enterprise. First, These may be terms that you have heard and are familiar with, and I need to tell you how I'm using these terms. The broad term that I use related to this phenomenon is the term pseudonymity. Pseudonymity literally means under a false name. There are two kinds of pseudonymity in the modern world. Today, there are people who write books under a pen name. So, example, when Marianne Evans wrote Middlemarch, she wrote it as George Eliot. Well, that George Eliot wasn't some famous person that she was claiming to be, it's just a pen name. Or Samuel Clemens wrote under the pen name Mark Twain, but he wasn't trying to claim to be somebody else, he was just writing under pen name. Well, in the ancient world, you also have instances of people using pen names. The famous book of Sophocles, the Anabasis, is written in the name of Themistogenes. It was just a pen name, wasn't somebody famous. So yeah, pen names. The other thing you have are people writing books claiming to be somebody that they're not, or books at least going under the name of somebody that they're not. That's what I'm calling pseudepigraphy. Literally, that has to do with a false name being at the title of a book. Or being so, there's a false name actually attached to a book, the name of somebody who is famous. But it turns out there are two kinds of pseudepigraphy. One kind of pseudepigraphy is when there's a book floating around that is written anonymously, so there's no author's name attached to it, written anonymously, and somebody else says, "Oh yes, this was written by so and so." And it's the so-and-so happens to be a famous person, even though the author doesn't claim to be that famous person. So you get this in the New Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John don't claim to be written by people named Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They're actually written anonymously. Later people said, oh, this gospel is written by Matthew, who is one of the disciples of Jesus. And so it's an anonymous book that has been attributed to somebody famous, even though the author doesn't make the claim. So that's not a forgery because the author's not claiming to be anybody. He's just writing a book anonymously and somebody later attributes it to someone else. The other kind of pseudepigraphy is when somebody writes a book claiming to be somebody that they're not when it's a well-known person that they're claiming to be. That's what I'm calling a forgery. So the pseudepigraphy, you have falsely attributed books and then you have books with an authorial claim. And so that gives me my definition of forgery. A literary work whose author falsely claims to be a well-known person. All right, so that is the definition that I'm using. And I use this definition whether I'm talking about, I use it for every kind of book. Wherever the book happens to show up in our surviving text. I emphasize this point because there are New Testament scholars who will talk about the book of 1 Timothy and the book of Titus and say that they're pseudepigrapha, but they won't say that they're forgeries. Whereas if they talk about books outside the New Testament and you have exactly the same thing, they'll call those forgeries. So forgeries are outside the New Testament and pseudepigrapha are inside the New Testament. But it's just because they're afraid to call these things forgeries. But that's what they mean. They're forgeries. So whoever wrote 1 Timothy was claiming to be the Apostle Paul, and he wasn't the Apostle Paul. What word do you use for that in normal discourse? That's a forgery. So even though I know people get upset when you talk about forgeries in the New Testament, I think it's a forgery if it's in the New Testament, it's a forgery if it's not in the New Testament. One of the questions that I won't be dealing with here today is whether there are forgeries in the New Testament. I think the answer is yes. I'll be dealing with that a little bit because I'm going to be arguing that there, in fact, is a counter-forgery in the New Testament, a definition of which I've not yet given you, counter-forgery. Before I get to that, I want to talk about why people wrote forgeries in the ancient world. It turns out there are a lot of reasons for writing forgeries in the ancient world that I don't need to go into. I'm going to just talk about one reason some people wrote forgeries, and we learn about this from a Neoplatonic philosopher named David. If someone is uninfluential and unknown, yet wants his writing to be read, he writes in the name of someone who came before him and was influential, so that through his influence he can get his work accepted. Well, that makes a lot of sense. If you are a Christian, for example, and you think that you understand theology well, and you understand the current situation of the church well, and you want to write something that will have some influence on people, but your name is Fred, and nobody's ever heard of you before, you can write your treatise and sign it Fred, but nobody's going to read it. But if you sign it the Apostle Paul, then somebody might read it. And so you might have the effect. So you won't get any fame and glory because you will be hiding behind the mask of Paul, but your writing may get a reading. And so so there were ancient people who realized that this is one of the reasons for people producing forgeries, is so that people would get their works accepted. All right, so all that by way of background for the topic that I want to focus on, which is a topic that I'm calling counter-forgery. Counter-forgery. So if a forgery is a literary book that whose author claims to be a well-known person that in fact he is not, what would be a counter-forgery? The way to explain what I mean by counter-forgery is by giving a few examples of the phenomenon. And so and once I give the examples, you'll see how it works. So I'll start with an interesting book called The Apostolic Constitutions. The Apostolic Constitutions. This is a book that was written in the 4th Christian century. The Apostolic Constitutions, written in the 4th Christian century. It's called the Apostolic Constitutions because it talks about how to constitute the church, how the church is to be organized, how it's to be structured, how it's to be run, who its leaders should be, what the qualifications of the leaders ought to be. So it's for the constitution of the church, but it's the apostolic constitutions because it's written in the names of the apostles. So the author himself claims to be Clement, who's not an apostle, obviously, but Clement was the third bishop of Rome, who allegedly was appointed to be bishop of Rome by Peter, the disciple of Jesus. So if you're in the Roman Catholic tradition, the way it works is Peter is the first pope, and after him there's a guy named Linus who becomes pope. Then after Linus there's a guy named Clement. So Clement is the third pope, and we have a lot of writings allegedly by Clement, but it turns out he probably didn't write any of these. We have a number of writings that are very famous. Some are well-known writings of Clement, including a group of books that talk about the adventures of Clement, his adventures where he starts off as an aristocrat in Rome who's a pagan who hears about the Son of God who got crucified in Judea and decides to go find out what's going on in Judea. He goes to Judea, he meets Peter, and Peter converts him. So this is in these book called the Pseudo-Clementines. And then he goes on these missionary journeys with Peter, and there are all these interesting escapades that he and Peter encounter as they go around the world converting people. And one of the things that he tells in these stories of these Pseudo-Clementines is he talks about the miracle contest that Peter used to get in, where Peter would, you have all these people going around claiming to be representatives of Christ, but they all are saying different, they all have different views of who Christ was and what the church is to believe and everything. And so how do you prove that you're right and the other guy is wrong? Well, if you can do better miracles than the other guy, then it shows that you are superior. And so the Pseudo-Clementines tell about these miracle contests, especially between Peter and the first arch-heretic, a guy named Simon Magus, where they engage in these miracle contests. And Peter's miracles are always better, of course, showing that Peter is the superior person, that he has the truth. And so these Pseudo-Clementines have all these escapades in them. Well, another book that Clement allegedly wrote is this Apostolic Constitutions. And in the Apostolic Constitutions, Clement quotes the apostles verbatim. And so there are places where the text will say, "I, Peter, say to you," and then there'll be some statement from Peter. "I, John, say to you," and there'll be a statement from John. "I, James, say to you." "I, Andrew, say to you." And so the apostles are speaking in the first person in this book, the Apostolic Constitutions. What's very interesting is near the end of the Apostolic Constitutions, a book which is being written in the name of the apostles 300 years after the apostles were dead, you get an exhortation in which the authors tell their readers not to read books that claim to be written by apostles but aren't. Well, that's what this is. This is a book that's claiming to be written by the apostles that's not written by the apostles. So what's going on? This book is trying to counter the fact that there are other forgeries out there. But it's doing it in a forgery. So it's an author forging a text telling you not to read forged texts. So that's a kind of counter forgery, a forgery that's countering other forgeries. So I'll give you another example. In the also in the 4th century, we learn about, in the early 4th century, we learn about a book called the Acts of Pilate from the Christian historian Eusebius. Many of you will know Eusebius. He's the 4th century church father who's called the father of church history because he wrote a history of Christianity in 10 volumes that we still have today that traces the history of Christianity from the days of Jesus up to his own day, right up to the time of the conversion of the Emperor Constantine. So it's a history of the first 300 years of Christianity in 10 volumes. So Eusebius tells a lot of stories about what happened in early Christianity, and he's our main source of information for a lot of the history of early Christianity. Even though he's biased and he has his own points of view and he selectively uses his sources, he's problematic as a source, but in some places he's our only source. He tells us in one place in his book, The Church History, that there was, during the reign of Maximin Daya in the early 4th century, there was a book that was circulating called the Acts of Pilate. And Eusebius doesn't tell us very much about it, but apparently this was an account that described the trial and death of Jesus from Pilate's point of view, that showed that Jesus really got what he deserved. Okay, so it was a pagan account of Jesus' death that the emperor liked a lot. The emperor Maximin Daya liked it so much that he put out an edict that this was to be required reading of schoolboys. So learning to read and write, this was one of their textbooks they were supposed to use. So this is obviously in opposition to Christianity. Well, Eusebius mentions this Acts of Pilate, but we don't have it anymore. It didn't survive antiquity, so we don't know really what was in it. We do happen to have, though, a book called The Acts of Pilate, which is a book that apparently was written a few years later that tells the story from the Christian perspective. And we still have that book. This is a very interesting book, The Acts of Pilate, for a lot of reasons. It tells some very interesting stories about Jesus' trial. And so, just to give you an example of it, when Jesus is going to be brought in before Pontius Pilate in order to be judged, and the Roman standard bearers are standing around Pilate's here, and you got these Roman standard bearers holding the standard that have an image of Caesar on the top of the standard, and so Pilate orders Jesus to come in for trial. Jesus walks through the door, and the standard bearers bow down and worship to him with the image of Caesar. And the Jewish authorities who see this happen get incensed. They say, "What are you doing? You're making Caesar worship Jesus." And the standard bearers say, "We couldn't help it. They did it themselves." And so so the Jews said, "Get out of here." And so they got six burly Jewish guys to hold these standards. And they send Jesus out of the room. And they say, "Okay, come back in now." You know, they got these guys, burly guys holding it. And Jesus comes in and they bow down again and worship to Jesus. So, you know, so this is showing that, of course, that Jesus is recognized as divine, even by the divine Caesar. And within this account, Pilate recognizes Jesus as divine. The Jewish authorities even admit he's divine. And so the whole thing is set up to portray Jesus in a very, very favorable light. Well, why was this Acts of Pilate written? It was probably written because this pagan Acts of Pilate was floating around and the Christians wanted to set the story straight. And so it's written in the name of Pilate, but Pilate obviously didn't write it. It's a forgery. Well, but it's a counter-forgery. It's countering another book that is forged. See how it works? So that's the phenomenon I'm talking about when I'm talking about counter-forgery. So just by way of definition, a counter-forgery is a forgery designed to counter another literary work that is also a forgery. Scholars have not noticed this phenomenon, or they haven't paid any attention to it. And so this is what my next book is on. It'll be a scholarly book, but it's going to be dealing with these counter-forgeries because it turns out there are a bunch of them. And I'm going to talk about two of them in my remaining 20 minutes or so. Two of them that I think can rightly be called counter-forgeries. One is a book that you may not have ever heard of, and one is a book that you almost certainly have heard of. So first, the book that you may not be familiar with, The Letter of Paul to the Laodiceans. Now, in the New Testament, there are 13 letters that claim to be written by the Apostle Paul. And the letter to the Laodiceans is not one of them. but we do have in ancient manuscripts a 15th letter. We actually have more than that. But in some manuscripts of the Bible, we have this letter included as a letter from Paul to the church in the town of Laodicea. The letter is the letter survives in Latin manuscripts. We have about 100 Latin manuscripts of this letter. About 100 Latin manuscripts. There were Christians throughout the Middle Ages who thought it was authentically by Paul, and thought it should be included in the Bible. In the German Bibles, done before Martin Luther did his translation, it was included as a 15th letter in the history of the German Bible translation. And so some Latin-speaking Christians, some German-speaking, some other Christians, thought that this book really was written by Paul, and that it should be included as one of the Pauline letters of the New Testament. What is striking to scholars today who studied the letter to the Laodiceans is just how banal and uninteresting it is. It is a pastiche of Pauline phrases just kind of thrown together that has no point. So scholars constantly write about this by trying to... try to outdo one another in describing just how banal this book is and how it doesn't seem to have any point. So it starts off by saying, Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, grace to you and peace. I thank my God for you. Don't be troubled by people who speak vainly. May God grant you perfect knowledge. The Lord will grant us mercy. God is working in you. Do all things without sin. Rejoice in the Lord. I mean, it's just these kind of Pauline phrases that are usually in a Pauline letter are being used to emphasize something. But here they're not emphasizing something. It's just a string of a bunch of Pauline phrases. And so scholars have long wondered what's going on here. And nobody thinks Paul wrote this thing. But why did somebody write it? Normally, if you forge something, if you're going to forge a document, you're doing it to make a point, because you want to emphasize something, or you've got some argument you're trying to win, or there's some controversy you're trying to weigh in on, and there's usually some point, but there doesn't seem to be a point about this letter to the Laodiceans. Well, why was it written? The most common explanation is that this relates to something going on in the New Testament in the book of Colossians, one of Paul's other letters that is in the New Testament. In Colossians chapter 4, verse 16, the author says that the Colossians, the people living in the church of Colossae, are to share this letter, the letter to Colossians, with the letter with the church in Laodicea, and they're to read the letter from the Laodiceans. In other words, there's a reference to a letter of Laodiceans in Colossians 4:16. And so what most scholars have said is that what's going on here then is that some later writer saw this reference in Colossians 4:16, that there's a letter to the Laodiceans, and he came up with a letter to the Laodiceans, because otherwise we didn't have it. And so he forged this letter to fill the lack that you have because of Colossians 4:16, okay? And simply took a bunch of Pauline phrases, threw them together, and published that as the letter to the Laodiceans mentioned in Colossians. Colossians, by the way, is one of the disputed Pauline letters. Scholars debate whether Paul actually wrote Colossians or not. Probably most critical scholars think Paul did not write Colossians, but that's irrelevant for my point here. I wonder if there's a deeper reason for the letter to the Laodiceans. I think there is a deeper reason, and it's a little bit complicated, but the way it works is this. We have a number of lists from the early church of books that the authors of these lists thought were to be parts of the New Testament. So we have church fathers who say, these are the books of the New Testament. The four Gospels, the book of Acts, the Pauline letter, and they'll list the books. The first such list we have is a list called the Muratorian Canon, which was discovered in the 17th century by a guy named Muratori, and so it got named after him. And it's a Latin list of the books that the author thought belonged in the New Testament. It's a list that probably comes from the late 2nd century. And this list includes most of our books of the New Testament, plus some others. It's missing some of the books that we have. It adds a few that we don't have. So it's not exactly our 27-book New Testament. But in this list, in the Muratorian Canon, probably from the late 2nd century, probably from Rome, there's a reference to some books that are not to be accepted as part of the canon. And in particular, it mentions some forgeries that are committed by the followers of Marcion. Now, I don't know if you know who Marcion is, but in case you don't, Marcion is a famous 2nd century heretic who believed that Paul was the only apostle who got everything right, and that that all the other apostles were wrong, and that since Paul differentiated, as we're going to see in my next example, differentiated between following the law and following the gospel. The law of the Jews cannot make you right with God. Only the gospel of Christ crucified can make you right with God. So it's faith in Christ that matters, not the law. And so Paul, according to Marcion, Paul got rid of the law. And so Marcion published an edition of the Bible that did not have the Old Testament in it. In fact, it only had a copy of the Gospel of Luke and 10 of Paul's letters, and that was it. That was his entire canon of Scripture, 11 books. Well, he was very persuasive to a lot of people in his day, Marcion, in part because almost everybody converting to Christianity was a Gentile. And most of the Gentiles didn't like Jews anyway, so get rid of them and get rid of their holy book, and we're different. We have the gospel of Christ, which is apart from the law. There were several books that were written by followers of Marcion that supported their point of view that were forgeries. And the Muratorian canon condemns these Marcionite forgeries. And it names two of them. A Marcionite forgery in the name of Paul, written to the Alexandrians, and a Marcionite forgery in the name of Paul written to the Laodiceans. Okay? So, late 2nd century, we know of Christians who are condemning a Marcionite forgery of the letter to the Laodiceans. Is this referring to our letter to the Laodiceans that we still have in Latin translations? I think, most scholars think the answer is absolutely no, because there's nothing in the letter to the Laodiceans that makes it look like it's Marcionite. See, in other words, it doesn't grind a Marcionite axe. It doesn't take a Marcionite position. It doesn't argue against the law. It doesn't argue against Judaism. It doesn't do anything that Marcion did. So this letter, Laodiceans, is not the letter being referred to in the Muratorian canon. What is it then? So my theory is this. Early Christians who knew that there's a Marcionite letter to the Laodiceans, which would be the letter allegedly referred to in Colossians 4:16, decided to displace the Marcionite letter to the Laodiceans, which we no longer have, with the real letter to the Laodiceans by forging one, which sounded a lot like Paul, because it just simply took over a bunch of Pauline phrases. And so it sounded very Pauline. But why would you forge if it didn't make any point? Because the existence of the letter is the point. The letter, by existing, shows that it is the letter to the Laodiceans versus this Marcionite letter to the Laodiceans. And so it tries to displace the Marcionite forgery with itself. And so it's a forgery countering another forgery. Okay, that's what I think's going on. Does that make sense? See how that works? Okay, so well, maybe it works. I think it works. That would be a counter forgery. Well, let me give you one other example. This one from within the New Testament, and this one is equally complicated. maybe a little bit more complicated. The letter of James, I'm going to argue, is a counter forgery. The letter of James in the New Testament, one of the so-called Catholic epistles, comes right after the book of Hebrews, the book of James, a favorite book for many people because it contains a number of very interesting and important ethical exhortations. So, the book of James. The book of James is written in the name of James, who is presumably the James, the famous James, James, the brother of Jesus. The book contains a number of ethical exhortations about how to live, and it emphasizes that you need to live well, you need to do good, you need to do good works, that you shouldn't simply trust your faith to put you right with God. You need to do good things. You need to be a good person and do good deeds to be right with God. And so it's a string of ethical exhortations without a lot of coherence. I mean, it's sort of one ethical passage after the other. A short book of 5 chapters, but a very interesting book. And a book that has been controversial over the years. If you're familiar with Martin Luther's attitudes, he didn't like the book of James for reasons that we will see later. When Martin Luther translated his New Testament, he put James in as an appendix with a few other letters he didn't like. The book of James, as I indicated, claims to be written by James, and I there are a lot of people named James in the ancient world, but scholars are pretty convinced that this James is claiming to be the James, who was the brother of Jesus, who became the leader of the church in Jerusalem. The bishop of the church in Jerusalem was a man named James. And the reason for thinking that the author is claiming to be that James is because he doesn't identify himself further. In other words, if he was some other James who wasn't widely known, he'd probably say who he was. But by not saying who he was, he's assuming that the audience knows, oh, he's that James. And so virtually everybody thinks that this person either is or is claiming to be James, the brother of Jesus. So the question is whether that's right. Was he that person? And in fact, I think there are reasons for thinking that this person was not really James. That is, somebody claiming to be James who wasn't James. And I'm going to give you two reasons for suspecting that probably this was not really the brother of Jesus writing this book. So, first, we have some ideas about what the historical James, the brother of Jesus, stood for. We know what James stood for because one person who actually knew James tells us a few things about him, namely the Apostle Paul. Paul knew James, as he indicates in, for example, the book of Galatians, chapter 2. And it becomes clear in reading Paul's letter to the Galatians that James was very Jewish in his interpretation of the gospel. And later, Jewish Christians claimed James as their champion. James, like other Jewish Christians, apparently believed that his brother Jesus, he knew that his brother Jesus was thoroughly Jewish. He came from a Jewish household, and he kept the Jewish law, and he kept Jewish customs. He believed that he died and was raised from the dead, and he came to believe that he was the Jewish Messiah. But for James, Jesus was the Jewish Messiah sent from the Jewish God to the Jewish people in fulfillment of the Jewish law, so that if you want to be a follower of Jesus, you have to be Jewish. Which meant that if you were a man, it meant you had to be circumcised, because you have to be circumcised if you're Jewish. If you're a man or a woman, it meant you had to keep the kosher food laws, so no shrimp salad and no ham sandwiches, and you had to keep kosher. You have to observe the Sabbath. You keep the Jewish festivals. It's a Jewish religion, and so you have to be Jewish. This is James, the historical James's emphasis, as we know from the writings of Paul, the Jewishness of Christianity, specifically keeping Jewish ritual law. So that's what we know about the historical James. What is striking about this? What is striking about this particular book, the book of James, is that those Jewish concerns are absent. There's no reference in all of these exhortations that he gives. There are no references to you need to be circumcised, you need to keep the Sabbath, you need to keep kosher, you need to observe the festivals. There's nothing that James, the historical James, emphasized, that we know that he emphasizes, nothing like that in the book of James. Instead, it's about other things. And so if James is going to be writing a book to Christians around the world, which is basically what the book of James is, how is it that he wouldn't say anything that we know that he normally emphasized? Well, it makes you think that maybe this book isn't written by James. And there's further evidence of that, which has to do with the question of historical plausibility. The question being, could James write the historical James? I'm going to contend that probably the historical James did not know how to write. This is not a particularly wild claim, because in fact, the vast majority of people in the ancient world could not write. Most of us here cannot write a book that would be counted as scripture, and most of us here have college educations. Even having a college education doesn't qualify you really to write such a compelling little book. Did James have a college education? The historical man James? Well, no. In fact, he did not. What do we know about the family of Jesus? What we know is that they came from the little hamlet Nazareth, which wasn't even a one horse town. There wasn't a horse in the entire town. It was a little hamlet where there were apparently there were no schools, there were no public buildings. I mean, it was a small collection of houses, rough houses. If the synagogue would have probably meant going to somebody's house and having a worship service on Sabbath. James was was lower class, and only the upper classes learned to read and write in the ancient world. So there have been studies of ancient literacy, the most famous of which is by a guy named William Harris, who says that at the very best of times in the ancient world, maybe 15% of the population could read. By best of times, he's talking about Athens during the days of Plato. You know, in Athens, in the days of Plato, maybe 15% of the population could read. Well, okay, what about rural Galilee in Roman times, in a little hamlet like Nazareth? Can 15% of the people read? No, probably. There might be one or two people who can read. And the thing is that the only people who can read in the ancient world are the people who are rich enough to afford the leisure to go to school, to learn to read. Reading was taught in schools. Now, some people think that with Jews there was an exception, that all Jewish boys went to synagogue school and learned to read. Actually, it doesn't look like that's the case. In most cases, it looks like even Jewish boys couldn't. They might learn the Torah, but they learned it orally. They didn't learn to read it. Roman period, Roman, Jewish, Palestine, maybe 10% of the population could read, and those 10 would be the upper class elite. And the other thing to think about is that in the ancient world, reading and writing were two different activities. For us, it's the same thing, because when we learn to read, we learn to write. But in the ancient world, they taught reading separately from writing. More people could read than could write. And what I mean by writing is the people could write, most of them could simply sign their names. It was only the really upper crust elite who could compose a sentence, let alone a paragraph, let alone a book. Very few people could do that in the ancient world. Moreover, James, the historic James, was a speaker of Aramaic. Aramaic was his language. The book of James in the New Testament is written in highly literate Greek. Well, could James, the brother of Jesus, an uneducated peasant from the hamlet of Nazareth, be able to compose in Greek a book like this? I think it's completely unlikely. Which means somebody else living later is writing this book. So it doesn't contain his distinctive emphases, and it doesn't look like he could probably write anyway. So I'm thinking that whoever wrote this book, it wasn't James. It was somebody claiming to be James. Why do I think it's not just a forgery, but a counter-forgery? Reasons for the forgery. What does that mean? I don't know. It's important to see what the emphases are of this book in order to understand its nature as a counter-forgery. You have to see why this book was apparently written. This book does have a polemical edge to it. In other words, it's involved in a controversy, as the central passages of the book show quite clearly. The main polemical emphasis, in other words, the main emphasis of the controversy, has to do with the problem of the relationship of what the author calls faith and works. This is probably the most familiar passage for people who know about the book of James, chapter 2, verses 14 through 26. What does it profit a person if someone says that he has faith, but he does not have works? Can faith save him? This author is going to argue that it's not enough just to believe, you also have to live a good life. You have to do good works to be right with God. Do you want to know, O foolish person, that faith without works is dead? If you don't do good deed, your faith means nothing. It's dead. You see, a person is justified by works, not by faith alone. Okay, a person is justified by works, not by faith alone. Now that might sound familiar to you because it sounds just the opposite of what Paul says, as we'll see in a second. This person wants to emphasize that faith has to have works or it's dead, and he uses as his key example Abraham. Abraham was justified by the good deeds he did, or by the deeds he did. He was justified by his works, not by his faith. That's interesting, because when Paul emphasizes that it's faith that makes a person right with God, not the works of the law, he uses Abraham as his example, as somebody who is justified by faith, not by doing works of the law. Okay? So, James emphasizes a person is justified by works and not by faith alone. Contrast that with what Paul says in, for example, Galatians chapter 2, verse 16. We know that a person is not justified by the works of the law, but by faith in Jesus Christ. This sounds like it's the opposite. So we have believed in Christ Jesus that we might be justified by faith in Christ and not by the works of the law. For by the works of the law, no flesh, nobody will be justified. Or take what he says in Romans, a little bit more pithy. Therefore, Paul says, we conclude that a person is justified by faith apart from the works of the law. So James says a person is justified by works, not by faith alone. Paul says a person is justified by faith apart from the works of the law. What? So it sounds like James is arguing against Paul. And this is the reason that Martin Luther found this book, James, so problematic. Because for Martin Luther, it's faith that makes a person right with God, not your works. And so he was opposed to the Roman Catholic Church that thought that you had to do good deeds in order to be right with God. Luther thought you don't have to do anything to be right with God. God made you right with himself by having Christ die. You simply accept that. You don't do anything to be right. If you think you have to do anything, then in fact you are compromising God's gracious act of Christ's death for Martin Luther. And so he put James in an appendix of his Bible as what he called a right straw-y epistle. It has no substance to it. It's all straw. All right. Well, I think Luther got it wrong. And I think scholars have gotten it wrong when they've argued that James is opposing Paul. Even though I just read those verses that sounds like they're opposite, I don't think, in fact, that James is opposing Paul. And here's the reason. When Paul says you are justified by faith, not by the works of the law, he's saying that you are not made right with God by doing the things that Jews have to do according to the Jewish law. Works, for Paul, means works of the Jewish law. It means circumcision, kosher foods, Sabbath observance, festival observance, sacrifices in the temple, whatever. These are the things the law requires Jews to do. And Paul says a person is made right with God apart from doing any of those things. In other words, a person made right with God, whether they're Jewish or Gentile, by faith in Christ. So when Paul talks about works, he's talking about specifically Jewish activities that fulfill what the Jewish law requires. And that's not what James is talking about. James, when he uses the word works, does not call them works of the law. He's talking about doing good deeds. Feeding the hungry, helping the poor, doing things that you ought to do as a moral individual. You can't be saved just by faith. You have to do good deeds. So when Paul uses the word works, he's talking about works of the law. When James uses works, he's not talking about works of the law. So they're actually not contradicting each other. They're talking about different things. Okay, with me so far? So, who is James arguing against if he's not arguing against the historical Paul? Well, as it turns out, Paul had some followers who took his teaching of works, salvation by faith apart from the works of the law, and started stressing it in a way that he did not stress. There are some writings that go under the name of Paul that seem to understand Paul's teaching against works of the law as being teaching against works for salvation, good deeds. Give you an example from the New Testament. The book of Ephesians. In the book of Ephesians, which is also one of the Pauline letters, the author talks about faith and works, but in terms that are not like Paul so much as they're like what James is opposing. Ephesians 2, verses 8 through 10. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it's the gift of God, not as a result of works, lest anyone should boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. Now, this author, claiming to be Paul, talks about salvation by faith, not by works, but he's not talking about works of the Jewish law, he's talking about good deeds. You're not saved by doing good deeds, you're saved by faith. So Ephesians 2, verses 8 and 9. Scholars broadly think that Ephesians was not actually written by Paul, for reasons I'm not going to go into now because my time is growing short. There are very good reasons for thinking that Ephesians was not written by Paul, but was written by a later follower of Paul. In other words, that Ephesians is what I'm calling a forgery. James does not seem to be countering a view found in Paul himself about good deeds, but his opposition does seem to apply to what you find in a book like Ephesians, which is written by a later follower of Paul in Paul's name. In other words, James, which I'm arguing is a forgery, is countering the view of the forged Paul in Ephesians. In other words, James is a counter-forgery. See how the logic works? So James then is a counter-forgery to the kind of view that you find in Ephesians. Okay, let me just conclude very quickly. I've got 15 minutes for questions. So my point is, I've got a broader point, which is that forgery was a very common practice in the early Christian church. It wasn't only found in the early Christian church. It was a broad practice in the world at large. In the Roman world, in the Greek world, we have lots of forgeries for lots of purposes. But we especially find it, we do find it. We find it in the early Christian church, about as far back as we go. A lot of books in the New Testament were not written by the people who are claimed as their authors. Those are forgeries. Some of those forgeries and some of the later Christian forgeries are written specifically to counter claims found in other forgeries, and so that's the phenomenon I'm calling counter-forgery.